do so, of course, just go to the Radio 3 website, follow the links to Music Matters, and you can also download it as a podcast at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.
Sunday morning for me is all about just doing something for yourself. It's about relaxing with the papers. It's about seeing your friends, seeing your family. It is that one part of the week where you get to unwind. So what we do is very simple. We go out there, we pick great recordings, whether it's brand new releases or vintage music. We've got concert listings, your concert reviews of what you've seen and heard, what you've loved. Musical Marmite, you write in and tell us the music and the artists that you love and hate, the kind of people that divide everybody down the middle. And we've always got your musical notes and queries. This is the time and the place where you get to listen to great music and where you get to just have a bit of fun and talk to the other people who are enjoying the show. Whatever your Sunday morning holds, I hope you'll spend it with me, Susie Klein, on BBC Radio 3 every Sunday from 10.
BBC Radio 3, 90 to 93 FM on digital radio and also online. Just gone 1 o'clock, time for the news from Vaughan Savage.
The new commander of the NATO-led forces in Afghanistan, General David Petraeus, has called for a united effort in the Afghan war. He called on all elements in the 9-year-old conflict, civilian and military, Afghan and international, to work as one team. The general said cooperation was essential to defeating the Taliban, which was carrying out what he's described as an industrial strength insurgency. An army veteran who claims he was wrongly jailed in Afghanistan has begun an appeal against his sentence. Bill Shaw, who's 52 and from Leeds, was jailed for 2 years in March after being found guilty of bribery. His family claim his trial was a sham. A petrol tanker has exploded in the east of the Democratic Republic of Congo, killing at least 200 people. The vehicle overturned near the village of Song last night and blew up as people tried to gather the leaking fuel in the dark. A number of houses burned down. Five people are being questioned about the fatal stabbing of a 15-year-old boy outside his school in South London. It's believed Zach Olamegban was targeted in a pre-planned attack. Witnesses say he was chased down the street before being stabbed. A post-mortem will take place today. The billionaire investor and philanthropist Warren Buffett has given nearly £1.3 billion to charity. Most of the money will go to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Four foundations set up by the Buffett family will share the rest. In 2006, he pledged to give away 99% of his wealth to charity and has since made a big donation every year. It's women's final day at Wimbledon. Serena Williams will face Vera Zonarova of Russia in her bid to win the title for the fourth time. The defending champion is the overwhelming favourite. She hasn't lost a set so far in the tournament. The weather, it will be a mainly dry and sunny day in England and Wales, with just a few isolated showers. It will be breezier and cloudier in Scotland and Northern Ireland. The BBC News and Weather at 3 minutes past one.
And now the Early Music Show with Lucy Skeeping.
Welcome to the show. I'm in Nottingham today, not in some cosy studio, but at the mouth of a cave, which, slightly against my natural instincts, it must be said, I'm about to enter. It looks like there's going to be quite a climb ahead. I'm on the steps inside the ancient tunnel known as Mortimer's Hole, a secret passageway built into the castle rock. It's actually a man-made tunnel, about 12 feet high in places, sometimes a bit less. The walls and floor are wonderful sandy khaki cream, and it runs some 150 metres from the foot of the mound outside right into the castle itself, where it comes up inside the walls at what was originally the upper bailey. The tunnel was originally dug as a sort of medieval service route for the delivery of goods from the town into the castle, quite a modern idea, but it's now become a tourist attraction. Just come out into a lovely light bit where I can see right over the city. It's become quite a tourist attraction due to its connection with a dramatic escape, an abduction from the castle that happened more than 700 years ago in the 14th century. And now I'm going back into the darkness of the tunnel again. It's certainly a gripping story, this, with all the ingredients of a detective novel. A cast of wicked noblemen, a cruel stepfather, a teenage king, and a fearless gang of brave knights who smuggled him out of the castle at dead of night to restore him to his rightful place on the throne of England. It all happened on the night of October the 19th, 1330, more or less right here. But to understand just how and why these events came about, I need to give you a little background. The story begins with Edward II, a less than popular monarch who had rather an unfortunate reign. Enter Sir Roger Mortimer, a charismatic Welsh lord who began a passionate affair with the Queen, Isabella. The two lovers took the king hostage and, planning to rule in his place, raised an army in France, then returned to England to depose Isabella's son, the future Edward III. So, making Nottingham Castle right here their base, the two usurpers, that's Mortimer and Queen Isabella, now virtually took control of England. Outside their circle of cronies, Mortimer was a really hated figure. He confiscated royal land, he murdered all his opponents, and he kept the young Edward prisoner here in the castle. And Edward was just 14 years old and powerless to do anything about it. Or so they thought. Rescue came in the form of a daring plot led by Sir William Montague. The traditional story, and of course it's probably been embroidered over the centuries, the traditional story has it that over a post-hunting drink, Montague was introduced to a man called William Elland. Now, he was the overseer of the castle, and he told Montague about this secret underground passageway, the one I'm standing in right now. This would be the perfect escape route for young Edward. As dusk fell, about 24 men gathered on horseback at the edge of Nottingham. All of them were heavily armed. There must have been a mix of excitement and genuine fear in the air. After all, Mortimer had spies everywhere, and his own army was at the ready to fight to the death if necessary. But as Montague no doubt explained to them all, this was no time to be worried. The future of the English monarchy was at stake.
Now from the That's where the body was detained. With nihilus there he drained. Ah, Jesu, feed the holy heaven. With sharper thornless was bewed. The fair and nail was all bespent. With spot and blood may now be wed. Full of pain and woe, and wild and red. Ah, Jesu, thee smarter than a shale, and may her red from devil's lore. A sweat, Jesu, thee o'er. For thee a pain a sore. Schlicht mein Herte lovete, was Herte blood, was shed for me.
Well, as the night air grew colder, the men finally reached the agreed spot at the bottom of this rocky mound on which the castle stood. Carefully, they tethered their horses along the marshy river bank. A short walk, and they came to an opening in the ground, just as Ellen had told them. It was the entrance to the tunnel where I just started my climb. A look around, and they got in, ascending the long, steep slope up towards the castle. One by one, Montague and his men slipped through an inner door, and as quietly as possible, they climbed the stairs in the castle up to the Queen's chamber. Suddenly, one of Mortimer's men appeared. It was now or never, and with a cry of "Down with the traitors!" he was crushed in a pool of blood. Now Mortimer was on the scene, sword in hand to defend himself, while Isabella screamed to her son for mercy. A few minutes, and it was all over. Edward was bundled out to safety. There was no mercy for Mortimer. Bound and gagged, he was led down into the basement, pushed into the tunnel, and removed from Nottingham. Just a month later, he was hanged, drawn and quartered, his remains left to rot for all to see. This was where it all happened, in this passageway. Mortimer's Hole represents a really important turning point in English history. In fact, it was from this moment in the story that the reign of Edward III really began. And what a successful king he turned out to be. But before I tell you any more, I suppose I need to find my way out of here. Well, I've emerged out of the secret passageway into the daylight. I must say, it does seem incredibly bright out here by contrast. I'm standing on the terrace at the top of Castle Rock. It's a wonderful panoramic view of Nottingham. That's the university over there, and on the other side, Trent Bridge Cricket Ground, and the very modern headquarters of the Inland Revenue, I'm told, none of which, of course, were here in the 1300s, when this was all Sherwood Forest. The medieval music we've been hearing was all performed by the Hilliard Ensemble, and it's a taster for the rest of the programme, because on today's Early Music Show, we're focusing on the time of Edward III, who ruled this land for 50 years, right up until 1377. If ever there was a time when the idea of a nation called England first took root, it was probably this. Edward was one of our most charismatic monarchs, a man whom my guest today refers to as being the father of the English nation. And that guest is the writer and historian Ian Mortimer.
At the point Edward III came to the throne, he is a 14-year-old boy being governed by Roger Morton and Isabella to dominating characters who don't allow him to rule. And he can see his country, his kingdom, in disarray. At the beginning of his reign, he is told if you achieve anything, it's to stop the nobles fighting amongst themselves. And he has this target of how to become a great king, but he can see the nobles in disarray. He can see so much going wrong. He sees the government spending money left, right and centre, and really he sees his entire inheritance under threat.
Gaude Virgo Immaculate, one of the few pieces of music we can trace directly to the Royal Chapel of Edward III. It was performed by Liber Unusualis. Ian Mortimer, one of the many extraordinary things about Edward III is the way that not so very long after his escape from Nottingham, he managed to turn the country from complete disarray into a confident, prosperous superpower. He was clearly a man with enormous strength of character.
Yes, he was definitely a man's man. You cannot be a medieval king and not be a good war leader. You have to be a man who will deliver judgment fairly and firmly in the eyes of the people. So he's a very strong character. But he also has vision, and that is what really distinguishes the great medieval kings from the also-rans. And that vision is something he builds up. He increasingly has confidence, so he manages to change his kingdom. In fact, I've put forward the idea that really Edward III is more responsible for the idea of England as a nation than anybody else is. At the beginning of the reign, he's a king of a kingdom which is lots of disparate parts. By the end of his reign, England has become a unity and it has its own language. It is much more of a nation than it had been in 1327.
But he was always at war, whether it was with the Scots or the French. He started what we now refer to as the Hundred Years' War.
In the late 1330s, hostilities break out, and in 1340, Edward III actually claims to be King of France and has himself crowned King of France. He's very, very clever. As a strategist, he never offers the French a treaty, not until 1360, when he finally manages to secure an agreement whereby he's won back all the territory that his ancestors ever owned, which was a prophecy made at the beginning of his life. Only at that point does he offer the French a treaty. He constantly keeps the pressure on them.
Well, some more music now. Another motet, possibly from Edward's reign. The text not only refers specifically to Edward, but it asks God to bring about an end to the wars in France.
Oh,
And that was Gothic Voices with Singularis Laudis Digna Motet, which asked God to bring about the end of England's wars with the French. I suppose you could say one indisputable event was the fact that Edward actually captured the King of France at the Battle of Poitiers. I mean, it must have been an amazing battle, and the English army, I suppose, were really hot stuff.
The reason the English army was really very powerful was because Edward III oversaw the development of arrow power and fire power. So he personally says, we want to have many, many more archers and to be able to attack armies larger than our own. He demonstrates this at Halidon Hill, where he does the unthinkable. As a 20-year-old man, I have to add, 20-year-old man leads a small English army against a larger Scottish one, which is something you never do in medieval tactics, and he's victorious because he uses arrow power. At that point onwards, he starts using gunpowder too. So at Crecy, for example, there are guns at Crecy, and he starts using those in a similar way to attack knights before those knights actually reach his own men.
So the English get their royal prize at Poitiers. It must have done Edward's sort of image among his people the world of good. I mean, was there a lot of celebration and stuff going on? Were there lots of dinners?
There was a great line. One of the English chroniclers says, because the Pope, of course, was French and was living in France. And I think one of the chroniclers says something like, now the Pope has become French and Jesus has become English. We'll see who is the greater. And the comparison was directly Edward III is divine. Yes, I mean, that was really the icing on the cake, taking the King of France prisoner. And he was brought to England, of course, in a long procession up from the West Country, during which Edward III wanted to show off. So he had men dress up as Robin Hood-like figures in green with bows and arrows and knives, and they pretended to ambush the King of France on the way to Windsor. So, yes, it's a wonderful spectacle, and it really was the icing on the cake after years of victory.
So John was held prisoner in England, but he wasn't really, your ordinary sort of poor chap chained up with the thumbscrews, because he was living in some style, wasn't he?
Oh, yes. I mean, royal prisoners. Remember, a king acknowledges status and society is aligned all the way down. So a king who takes another king prisoner treats him like a king. So he'd have had his hounds and his hunting birds, and he'd have been able to eat very well, and he'd had his servants in captivity.
We've come across a really interesting piece by the French composer Pierre de Molin, which we believe was actually written for John whilst he was in England. And the text reflects the hardships of, as he says, languishing in a strange country. We'll hear it as an instrumental for Medieval Heart, performed by Andrew Lawrence King. Thank you. an anonymous instrumental reworking of a song by Pierre de Molin, De ce que folle pense, played on the medieval harp by Andrew Lawrence King. Ian, they say behind every great man there's a great woman. Edward had his queen, Philippa of Hainaut, didn't he?
Edward III's relationship with Philippa is one of the longest and closest. They were very close. I mean, you had to be close in order to have 12 children in the 14th century. So we know that Philippa was travelling all the time with Edward III, and she went abroad with him on some of his campaigns too. Women had a very distinct role in obtaining mercy for people. So the very, very famous example of the burghers of Calais, who are Edward sentences to be hanged, and of course Philippa begs mercy for them, and Edward grants mercy. So this is a role that's often employed by women. Edward III was very much the man's man. He would have condemned the criminal or his opponent to death and then expect somebody to step forward and implore him to be merciful, and of course he then graciously gives in and is merciful. So this double act is a little indicator of how they really operated as king and queen throughout this period. And of course, they became larger-than-life characters in the 14th century. They became supreme heroes, as it were, in Europe. So when they are later rest in Westminster, it's their portraits that are on those tombs in Westminster Abbey. They're not portrayed to look like great kings and queens. They really are. So they're portraits on those tombs.
Diabolus in Musica, with a motet that demonstrates the medieval practice of having three different texts, each with its own melody, all sung at the same time. And we know that particular piece, by the way, was among those that Philippa brought to England with her as part of her wedding dowry for her marriage to Edward III. You're listening to The Early Music Show with me, Lucy Skeeping, and we're exploring some of the music heard in England during the reign of Edward III with the help of my guest, the writer and specialist in the 14th century, Ian Mortimer. Edward's one of those kings we associate with the King Arthur myth, the idea of chivalry and all that. What's the story behind that?
Well, the king's fascination with Arthur goes back to Edward III's grandfather, Edward I. It was during Edward I's reign that King Arthur was supposedly dug up at Glastonbury. But he latches onto it because of this idea of leadership.
What way did this kind of work in practice?
Tournaments is one way. I mean, the fact that he had his nobles all fighting each other. There's also the round table aspect. In 1344, prior to the Order of the Garter, he established or set about establishing this large round table tournament at Windsor, which was going to take place every year. He encourages the idea of knights living out this championship role, I suppose. Various knights take on Arthurian names, and you quite often find nicknames being applied to people which come from the Arthurian legends too.
But to what extent did it really have meaning and consequence when it came to life for these people?
It has huge consequence. It gives people the codes and the rules by which they can take pride and advance themselves. It creates a structure for the court and for people to gather around Edward and for him to reward them and then for them to make their marks. It allows also Edward to sort of build a group of men in his project towards England as a nation. A good example of this is when the Holy Roman Emperor dies. The electors who elect the Holy Roman Emperor, they ask Edward to be the Holy Roman Emperor, and he turns them down. By that stage, it is better for him to be King of England and King of his own court. Whether you compare it to Arthur and Camelot or not, Edward III of England is a more prestigious title than Holy Roman Emperor. So he has built everybody into this great show of greatness, and no one can rival that as a sort of kingship. And it lasts. I mean, what he's actually touched on is something that really has staying power. 300 years later, more than 300 years later, Joshua Barnes, writing at Cambridge, states that Edward III was perhaps the greatest king the world had ever known. And Edward III's impact for later generations nearer his own time is huge. I mean, this legacy of Edward III of England being like Arthur of Camelot is something that builds at the end of the 14th century, so that Henry V, his great-grandson, wants to be like Edward III. It's a very English idea of kingship, and it's seen as being the pinnacle of what kings can achieve.
Oh,
A motet in praise of the Virgin Mary by Philippe de Vitry, performed again by Gothic Voices. De Vitry was a diplomat and a scientist, as well as a musician, and he was also the author of a treatise considered to be a landmark in its time. It laid out the principles of what became known as the Ars Nova, a sort of new style which originated in that medieval hotbed of musical development, the Cathedral of Notre Dame in Paris. And it was here, really, that the Western world saw the beginning of harmony, the idea of putting two or three different lines together as opposed to the old style of simple one-line plain chant. And, of course, it soon spread to England. In fact, the source of that particular motet is Durham Cathedral. So, Ian Mortimer, French culture, as we've heard, was obviously a potent one in the 14th century, but to what extent were the English developing their own distinct culture at this time?
Oh, a fantastic rate. I mean, the very fact that by the end of the reign of Edward III, most people feel an obligation to speak some sort of English is itself a major change. In 1327, the aristocracy, the nobility, everybody who's anybody spoke French. By 1377, everybody understood that if they weren't actually speaking English as their first language, they ought to understand what everybody in England was saying. Edward III himself leads this, using some mottos in English, and also in 1362, on his 50th birthday, declares that the language that you can use in court to plead your case should be your own tongue, thereby acknowledging English as an official language for the first time. Beyond that, the idea of nationalism and his wars all find their cultural and resting place in Windsor Castle and his great castles up and down the Thames. Windsor Castle especially, and although the walls are very much as they were in the 13th century, the interior of that castle was largely built by Edward III. At £53,000 or thereabouts, it was the most expensive building in the whole of medieval England.
And by the late 14th century, we begin to get some really important literature in English, don't we?
Yes, you'd had early in the reign, you'd had some sort of experiments in English poetry from Laurence Mignon and people like that, but you've got Chaucer at the end of the reign. In fact, Chaucer was serving in the royal household. Edward III had to ransom Chaucer at one point when he got inadvertently captured. When you have that flowering of English literature, then you really can see how far we've come.
In fact, the next piece we're going to hear is actually mentioned by name in Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. Chaucer called it Angelus ad Virginum, and as an indication of just how popular it was, we're going to hear three different versions of it from three different sources. First, for solo voice from late 13th century East Anglia. Then we're going to hear it as a duet from Adele near Leeds in Yorkshire from around 1349. And as a trio, as found in a manuscript from Dublin in about 1360.
Nicht.
Angelus ad Virginem, or Gabriel from Heaven King, three different versions of this popular tune performed there by Liber Unusualis. Ian, we've talked a lot about wars and about language and about politics, but obviously this is a music programme. So do we know anything about Edward III's personal taste in music?
Well, I can't tell you which tunes he chose or anything like that, because unfortunately the documents I study don't have that data in them. But what they do have are frequent references to the rewards paid to musicians, and those can be very interesting. For example, in 1335, one Master Andrew Clarencel, herald, king of arms, and his fellow minstrels were paid 50 marks for performing to Edward III. 50 marks, that's £33, 6 shillings and 8 pence. At a time when a daily wage for a skilled labourer was about fourpence. So it's a colossal amount of money he pays to musicians. And frequently you come across this. There's a Bernard the Fiddler who plays for Edward III as a solo performer in front of a statue once. And Edward III gives him, I think it was half a mark as a reward or something along those lines. It's a huge amount of money. And they had minstrels around them all the time. So any event, any feast would have been accompanied by minstrelsy. The coronation, the churching of the children, any feast on the ritual days of the year would have had minstrels. And of course, this is in addition to all the religious music, which they'd have heard on a daily basis, because kings did tend to hear mass every single day.
Can you sum up why is his reign so important to our understanding of English history?
With Edward III, we see the beginnings of modern culture, both in the literature of the culture of the time, in the political organisation of the time, in the parliamentary representation of the time. And in this figurehead of the government holding it all together from Westminster. So over that 50-year period, we really see developing the sorts of government and national identity that we're familiar with. And if I may add, Edward III personally has a role in being the father of the English nation, as he had 12 children, over 400 descendants by 1500, and mathematically, he's probably an ancestor of everybody of English descent living in England today. So he's not only dynamically the father of the nation as a figurehead, he's also literally a father too.
How lovely. We might all have some royal blood. I'll enjoy
yes.
that. Ian Mortimer, many thanks for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Sub Arturo Plebs, music by Johannes Alanus, or John Alain. The piece clearly shows how the sophisticated new styles from Notre Dame had indeed arrived in England by this time. In fact, the piece was originally a song, a three-voice motet with separate texts that provide all sorts of historical information about English musical life in the latter half of the 14th century. It's all on the subject of music and musicians. The tenor line quotes from the Bible, while the middle voice sings the praises of a succession of historical figures, such as Pope Gregory, Pythagoras, and the musical theorist Guido d'Arezzo. But what's really got music historians jumping about is that the song refers to Johannes Alain himself, making it one of the earliest compositions that actually names its composer. Not only that, but it also lists some 14 of Alain's contemporaries, musicians working at the English court, and describes their accomplishments. I doubt whether you'll have heard of any of them, but historians have been able to trace several of them back to real flesh-and-blood musicians employed at the Chapel Royal. There's also a reference in the motet to Arthur and the Order of the Garter, which may be an allusion to Edward himself. course, it would be nice to be sure just how far this piece was really connected to Edward, even whether it was written during his reign at all. With so little surviving English music from this period, it is very hard to be certain about anything. I'm standing at the foot of the castle in Nottingham, outside the famous pub, Ye Olde Trip to Jerusalem. Yes, another reminder of England's medieval past. I'm going to pop inside and have a look around. Thomas Jesus in Domini Ave Premura Emula Fili Protuens Ossa Divina Repetita Mira Caritate Fa Divina Repetita Mira Caritate Fatutina Vespertina Lucis in Create Gratutina Vespertina Lucis in Trip to Jerusalem is built right into the caves of the Castle Rock, and it proudly advertises itself as England's oldest inn. And it may well be, because legend has it that the men going off to the Third Crusade gathered here beside Nottingham Castle to rest before the long journey. And we've just heard a 14th century song about making pilgrimage to the shrine of St Thomas à Becket in Canterbury, performed there by the Hilliard Ensemble. All we really have of the distinctive English music from Edward's time, though, is fragments, a kind of medieval decor, a bit like this pub with its exposed stone walls and suits of armour and everything. And yet, from these fragments, it is possible to piece together a suggestion of the English style of the 14th century, a style in which avant-garde techniques from the continent kind of intertwined with a national love of pleasing harmony. I'll leave you with an example of that special English sound, with its delight in major thirds, a very human sound against all those typically medieval open fourths and fifths. This is a ravishing piece, quite quirky to modern ears, I think. A motet that depicts Mary as the saviour of souls.
Yeah.
The 14th century Marian motet Virgo Salvavit, performed by Diabolus in Musica, directed by Antoine Gerber. Today's early music show on Edward III was presented by Lucy Skeeping and produced by Chris Wines.
This year, the City of London Festival is celebrating Portuguese-speaking culture and music. And we're bringing you some of the highlights in Performance on Three, starting on Wednesday evening with Sacred Polyphony from Brazil and Christmas songs from 17th century Africa. And on Thursday, Villa-Lobos combines Bach's contrapuntal technique and the Brazilian folk style in his famous Bachianas Brasileiras, No. 9. Among the world-class performers throughout the evening, there's a prominent role for Brazilian percussion virtuoso Adriano Adewale. Join me, Martin Handley, for music from the City of London Festival in Performance on 3, Wednesday and Thursday at 7, here on BBC Radio 3.
Well, now we have another chance to hear a recital broadcast live from London's Wigmore Hall last Monday. It's presented by Sarah Walker.
Romantic piano music lies at the heart of today's lunchtime concert. From Franz Schubert with the Four Impromptus, Opus 90, one of his most popular works, and from Robert Schumann, the Magnificent Fantasy, Opus 17, composed as a homage to his future wife, Clara. Offering this sumptuous two-part programme, Lars Vogt, born in Düren in West Germany in 1970, and now a pianist of international stature and a very welcome visitor to Wigmore Hall. So we start with Schubert's Four Impromptus, the Opus 90 set, which was composed in 1827, the year before his tragically early death. They're highly imaginative pieces, far away from the traditional sonatas of the classical era, and each one has a very well-defined character. The set begins with a simple statement in C minor, which Schubert builds into quite a substantial musical structure. The second impromptu is more light-hearted, mostly rippling scales, but with a couple of fiercer episodes to provide contrast. After that, we have a peaceful impromptu with a singing melody, and the set ends with a sparkling allegretto. Certainly been a busy season for Lars Vogt. His career has gone from strength to strength since he won second prize in the Leeds piano competition. That was 20 years ago. Here comes Lars Vogt now onto the stage here at Wigmore Hall to perform Schubert's Four Impromptus, Opus 90.